armed and taken up positions all along the south bank of the Marne. A wounded comrade told him of a bloody battle in a wood near the town called the Bois de Belleau. There had been terrible casualties on both sides, but the Americans had won. Back in Berlin, the papers continued to tell of German victories, but the lines on the maps got no nearer to Paris, and Walter came to the bitter conclusion that the spring offensive had failed. The Americans had arrived too soon. He was released from hospital to convalesce in his old room at his parents' house. On August 8th, an Allied attack at Amiens used almost 500 of the new tanks. These iron-clad vehicles were plagued with problems but could be unstoppable, and the British gained 8 miles in a single day. It was only 8 miles, but Walter suspected the tide had turned, and he could tell by his father's face that the old man felt the same. No one in Berlin now spoke of winning the war. One night at the end of September, Otto came home looking as if someone had died. There was nothing left of his natural ebullience. Walter even wondered if he was going to cry. "The Kaiser has returned to Berlin," he said. Walter knew that Kaiser Wilhelm had been at army headquarters in the Belgian hill resort called Spa. "Why has he come back?" Otto's voice dropped to a near whisper, as if he could not bear to say what he had to say in a normal voice. "Ludendorff wants an armistice." Chapter 32. October 1918. Maud had lunch at the Ritz with her friend Lord Remarque, who was a junior minister in the War Office. Johnny was wearing a new lavender waistcoat. Over the pot au feu, she asked him, "Is the war really coming to an end?"
"Everyone thinks so," Johnny said. "The Germans have suffered 700,000 casualties this year. They can't go on."
Maud wondered miserably if Walter was one of the 700,000. He might be dead, she knew, and the thought was like a cold lump inside her where her heart should be. She had had no word from him since their idyllic second honeymoon in Stockholm. She guessed that his work no longer took him to neutral countries from which he could write. The awful truth was that he had probably returned to the battlefield for Germany's last all-or-nothing offensive. Such thoughts were morbid, but realistic. So many women had lost their loved ones. Husbands, brothers, sons, fiancés. They had all lived through 4 years during which such tragedies happened daily. It was no longer possible to be too pessimistic. Grief was the norm. She pushed her soup dish away.
"Is there any other reason to hope for peace?"
"Yes. Germany has a new chancellor, and he has written to President Wilson, suggesting an armistice based on Wilson's famous 14 points.
"That is hopeful. Has Wilson agreed?"
"No. He said Germany must first withdraw from all conquered territories."
"What does our government think?"
"Lloyd George is hopping mad. The Germans treat the Americans as the senior partners in the alliance, and President Wilson acts as if they could make peace without consulting us."
"Does it matter?"
"I'm afraid it does. Our government doesn't necessarily agree with Wilson's 14 points.
Maud nodded.
"I suppose we're against point 5, about colonial peoples having a say in their own government."
"Exactly. What about Rhodesia and Barbados and India? We can't be expected to ask the natives permission before we civilize them. Americans are far too liberal, and we're dead against point 2, freedom of the seas in war and peace. British power is based on the navy. We would not have been able to starve Germany into submission if we had not been allowed to blockade their seagoing trade."
"How did the French feel about it?"
Johnny grinned. "Clemenceau said Wilson was trying to outdo the Almighty. God himself only came up with 10 points, he said.
"I get the impression that most ordinary British people actually like Wilson and his points."
Johnny nodded.
"And European leaders can hardly tell the American president to stop making peace."
Maud was so eager to believe it that she frightened herself. She told herself not to be happy yet. There could be such heavy disappointment in store. A waiter brought them Sol Waleska and cast an admiring eye at Johnny's waistcoat. Maud turned to her other worry.
"What do you hear from Fitz?"
Her brother's mission in Siberia was secret, but he had confided in her, and Johnny gave her bulletins.
"That Cossack leader turned out to be a disappointment. Fitz made a pact with him, and we paid him for a while, but he was nothing more than a warlord, really. However, Fitz is staying on, hoping to encourage the Russians to overthrow the Bolsheviks. Meanwhile, Lenin has moved his government from Petrograd to Moscow, where he feels safer from invasion.
Even if the Bolsheviks were deposed, would a new regime resume the war against Germany?
Realistically, no.
Johnny took a sip of Chablis. But a lot of very powerful people in the British government just hate the Bolsheviks.
Why?
Lenin's regime is brutal. So was the Tsar's. But Winston Churchill never plotted to overthrow him. Underneath, they're frightened that if Bolshevism is a success over there, it will come here next.
Well, if it's a success, why not?
Johnny shrugged. You can't expect people such as your brother to see it that way.
No, said Maud. I wonder how he's getting on.
2.
We're in Russia, Billy Williams said when the ship docked and he heard the voices of the longshoremen. What are we doing in fucking Russia?
How can we be in Russia?
Said Tommy Griffiths. Russia's in the east. We've been sailing west for weeks. We've gone halfway around the world and come at it from the other side. Tommy was not convinced. He leaned over the rail, staring.
The people look a bit Chinesey, he said. They're speaking Russian, though. They sound like that pony driver, Peshkov, the one who cheated the Ponty brothers at cards, then scarpered.
Tommy listened.
Aye, you're right. Well, I never.
This must be Siberia, Billy said. No wonder it's fucking cold.
A few minutes later, they learned they were in Vladivostok. People took little notice of the Aberowan pals marching through the town. There were already thousands of soldiers in uniform here. Most were Japanese, but there were also Americans and Czechs and others. The town had a busy port, trams running along broad boulevards, modern hotels and theatres, and hundreds of shops. It was like Cardiff, Billy thought, but colder. When they reached their barracks, they met a battalion of elderly Londoners who had been shipped there from Hong Kong. It made sense, Billy thought, to send old codgers to this backwater. But the pals, though depleted by casualties, had a corps of hardened veterans, who had pulled strings to have them withdrawn from France and sent to the other side of the globe. He soon found out. After dinner, the brigadier, a comfortable-looking man evidently close to retirement, told them they were to be addressed by Colonel the Earl Fitzherbert. Captain Gwyn Evans, the owner of the department stores, brought a wooden crate that had once held cans of lard, and Fitz climbed up on it, not without difficulty on account of his bad leg. Billy watched without sympathy. He reserved his compassion for Stumpy Pugh and the many other crippled ex-miners who had been injured digging the Earl's coal. Fitz was smug, arrogant, and a merciless exploiter of ordinary men and women. It was a shame the Germans had not shot him in the heart rather than the leg. "Our mission is fourfold," Fitz began, raising his voice to address 600 men. "First, we're here to protect our property. On your way out of the docks, passing the railway sidings, you may have noticed a large supply dump guarded by troops. That 10-acre site contains 600,000 tons of munitions and other military equipment sent here by Britain and the United States when the Russians were our allies. Now that the Bolsheviks have made peace with Germany, we do not want bullets paid for by our people to fall into their hands." "That doesn't make sense," Billy said loud enough for Tommy and the others around him to hear. "Instead of bringing us here, why didn't they ship the stores home?" Fitz glanced irritably in the direction of the noise, but continued. "Second, there are many Czech nationalists in this country, some prisoners of war and others who were working here pre-war, who have formed themselves into the Czech Legion, and are trying to take ship from Vladivostok to join our forces in France. They are being harassed by the Bolsheviks, and our job is to help them get away. Local Cossack community leaders will help us in this effort."
"Cossack community leaders?" Billy said. "Who is he trying to fool? They're bloody bandits."
Once again Fitz heard the dissident muttering. This time Captain Evans looked annoyed and walked down the mess hall to stand near Billy and his group.
"Here in Siberia there are 800,000 Austrian and German prisoners of war who have been set free since the peace treaty. We must prevent them returning to the European battlefield. Finally, we suspect the Germans of eyeing up the oil fields of Baku in the south of Russia. They must not be allowed to access that supply."
Billy said, "I've got a feeling Baku is quite a long way from here."
The brigadier said amiably, "Do any of you men have any questions?" Fitz gave him a glare, but it was too late. Billy said, "I haven't read nothing about this in the papers." Fitz replied, "Like many military missions, it is secret, and you will not be allowed to say where you are in your letters home.
Are we at war with Russia, sir? No, we are not. Fitz pointedly looked away from Billy. Perhaps he remembered how Billy had bested him at the peace talks meeting in the Calvary Gospel Hall. Does anyone other than Sergeant Williams have a question? Billy persisted. Are we trying to overthrow the Bolshevik government? There was an angry murmur from the troops, many of whom sympathized with the revolution. There is no Bolshevik government, Fitz said with mounting exasperation. The regime in Moscow has not been recognized by His Majesty the King. Have our mission been authorized by Parliament? The brigadier looked troubled. He had not been expecting this type of question, and Captain Evans said, That's enough from you, Sergeant. Let the others have a chance. But Fitz was not smart enough to shut up. Apparently it did not occur to him that Billy's debating skills, learned from a radical non-conformist father, might be superior to his own. Military missions are authorized by the War Office, not by Parliament, Fitz argued. So this have been kept secret from our elected representatives, Billy said indignantly. Tommy murmured anxiously, Careful, nobody. Necessarily, said Fitz. Billy ignored Tommy's advice. He was too angry now. He stood up and said in a clear, loud voice, Sir, is what we're doing legal? Fitz colored, and Billy knew he had scored a hit. Fitz began, Of course it is. If our mission have not been approved by the British people, or the Russian people, Billy interrupted, how can it be legal? Captain Evans said, Sit down, Sergeant. This isn't one of your bloody Labour Party meetings. One more word and you'll be on a charge. Billy sat down, satisfied. He had made his point. Fitz said, We have been invited here by the All-Russia Provisional Government, whose executive arm is a five-man directory based at Omsk, at the western edge of Siberia. And that, Fitz finished, is where you're going next. 3. It was dusk. Lev Peshkov waited, shivering, in a freight yard in Vladivostok, the ass end of the Trans-Siberian Railway. He wore an army greatcoat over his lieutenant's uniform, but Siberia was the coldest place he had ever been. He was furious to be in Russia. He had been lucky to escape 4 years ago, and even luckier to marry into a wealthy American family. And now he was back, all because of a girl. What's wrong with me? He asked himself. Why can't I be satisfied? A gate opened, and a cart drawn by a mule came out of the supply dump. Lev jumped onto the seat beside the British soldier who was driving it.
Aye, Sid, said Lev.
Watcha, said Sid. He was a thin man of about 40 with a perpetual cigarette and a prematurely lined face. A Cockney, he spoke English with an accent quite different from that of South Wales or upstate New York. At first Lev had found him hard to understand.
Have you got the whiskey?
Nah, just tins of cocoa. Lev turned around, leaned into the cart, and pulled back a corner of the tarpaulin. He was almost certain Sid was joking. He saw a cardboard box marked Fries, Chocolate, and Cocoa. He said, Not much demand for that among the Cossacks. Look underneath. Lev moved the box aside and saw a different legend. Teacher's Highland Cream, perfection of old Scotch whiskey. He said, How many? 12 cases. He covered the box.
Better than cocoa.
He directed Sid away from the city center. He checked behind frequently to see if anyone was following them, and looked with apprehension when he saw a senior U.S. Army officer, but no one questioned them. Vladivostok was crammed with refugees from the Bolsheviks, most of whom had brought a lot of money with them. They were spending it as if there were no tomorrow, which there probably was not for many of them. In consequence, the shops were busy and the streets full of carts like this one delivering goods. As everything was scarce in Russia, much of what was on sale had been smuggled in from China, or, like Sid Scotch, stolen from the military. Lev saw a woman with a little girl and thought of Daisy. He missed her. She was walking and talking now and investigating the world. She had a pout that melted everyone's heart, even Joseph Vyalov's. He had not seen her for 6 months. She was 2 and a half now, and she must have changed in the time he had been away. He also missed Marga. She was the one he dreamed about, her naked body wriggling against his in bed. It was because of her that he had got into trouble with his father-in-law and ended up in Siberia, but all the same, he longed to see her again.
Have you got a weakness, Sid? Said Lev.
He felt he needed a closer friendship with the taciturn Sid. Partners in crime required trust.
Nah,
said Sid. Only money. Does your love of money lead you to take risks?
Nah, just thieving.
And does thieving ever get you into trouble?
Not really. Prison once, but that was only for 6 months.
My weakness is women.
Is it?
Lev was used to this British habit of asking the question after the answer had been given.
Yes, he said. I can't resist them. I have to walk into a nightclub with a pretty girl on my arm.
Do you?
Yes, I can't help myself.
The cart entered a docklands neighborhood of dirt roads and sailors' hostels, places that had neither names nor addresses. Sid looked nervous. Lev said,
You're armed, yeah?
Nah, said Sid. I just got this.
He pulled back his coat to reveal a huge pistol with a foot-long barrel stuck into his belt. Lev had never seen a gun like it.
What the fuck is that?
Webley Mao's, most powerful handgun in the world. Very rare.
No need to pull the trigger, just wave it about. It'll scare people to death.
In this area, no one was paid to clear the streets of snow, and the cart followed the tracks of previous vehicles, or slid on the ice of little-used lanes. Being in Russia made Lev think of his brother. He had not forgotten his promise to send Grigory the Fair to America. He was making good money selling stolen military supplies to the Cossacks. With today's deal, he would have enough for Grigory's passage. He had done a lot of wicked things in his short life, but if he could make amends to his brother, he would feel better about himself. They drove into an alley and turned behind a low building. Lev opened a cardboard box and took out one bottle of scotch.
Stay here and guard the load, he said to Sid. Otherwise it will be gone when we come up.
Don't worry, said Sid, but he looked apprehensive.
Lev reached under his greatcoat to touch the holstered Colt 45 semi-automatic pistol on his belt. Then he went in through the back door. The place was what passed for a tavern in Siberia. There was a small room with a few chairs and a table. It had no bar, but an open door revealed a dirty kitchen with a shelf of bottles and a barrel. Three men sat near the log fire, dressed in ragged furs. Lev recognized the one in the middle, a man he knew as Sotnik. He wore baggy trousers tucked into riding boots. He had high cheekbones and slanted eyes, and he sported an elaborate mustache and side whiskers. His skin was reddened and lined by the weather. He might have been any age, between 25 and 55. Lev shook hands all round. He uncorked the bottle, and one of the men, presumably the bar owner, brought four non-matching glasses. Lev poured generous measures, and they all drank.
"This is the best whiskey in the world," Lev said in Russian. "It comes from a cold country like Siberia, where the water in the mountain stream is pure, melted snow. What a pity it is so expensive."
Sotnik's face was expressionless.
"How much?"
Lev was not going to let him reopen the bargaining. "The price you agreed to yesterday," he said. "Payable in gold rubles, nothing else."
"How many bottles?"
144.
"Where are they?"
"Nearby.
You should be careful. There are thieves in the neighborhood."
This might have been a warning or a threat. Lev guessed the ambiguity was intentional.
"I know about thieves," he said. "I'm one of them."
Sotnik looked at his two comrades. Then, after a pause, he laughed. They laughed too. Lev poured another round.
"Don't worry," he said. "Your whiskey is safe, behind the barrel of a gun."
That too was ambiguous. It might have been a reassurance or a warning.
"That's good," said Sotnik.
Lev drank his whiskey, then looked at his watch.
"A military police patrol is due in this neighborhood soon," he lied. "I have to go." "One more drink," said Sotnik.
Lev stood up.
"Do you want the whiskey?"
He let his irritation show. "I can easily sell it to someone else." This was true. You could always sell liquor.
"I'll take it. Money on the table."
Sotnik picked up a saddlebag from the floor and began counting out 5-ruble pieces. The agreed price was 60 rubles a dozen. Sotnik slowly put the coins in piles of 12 until he had 12 stacks. Lev guessed he could not actually count up to 144. When Sotnik had finished, he looked at Lev. Lev nodded. Sotnik put the coins back in the saddlebag. They went outside, Sotnik carrying the bag. Night had fallen, but there was a moon, and they could see clearly. Lev said to Sid in English, "Stay on the cart.
Be alert."
In an illegal transaction, this was always the dangerous moment, the buyer's chance to grab the goods and keep the money.
Lev was not taking any chances with Grigori's ticket money. Lev pulled the cover off the cart, then moved three boxes of cocoa aside to reveal the scotch. He took a case from the cart and put it on the ground at Sotnik's feet. The other Cossack went to the cart and reached for another case.
No,
said Lev. He looked at Sotnik.
The beg.
There was a long pause. On the driving seat, Sid pulled back his coat to reveal his weapon. Sotnik gave Lev the bag. Lev looked inside, but decided not to count the money again. He would have seen if Sotnik had slyly extracted a few coins. He handed the bag to Sid, then helped the others unload the cart. He shook hands all round and was about to get up on the cart when Sotnik stopped him.
Look, he said.
He pointed at an opened box.
There's a bottle missing.
That bottle was on the table in the tavern, and Sotnik knew it. Why was he trying to pick a quarrel at this stage? This was dangerous. He said to Sid in English,
Give me one gold piece.
Sid opened the bag and handed him a coin. Lev balanced it on his closed fist, then threw it in the air, spinning it. The coin flashed in the moonlight. As Sotnik reached out reflexively to catch it, Lev jumped onto the seat of the car. Sid cracked the whip.
Go with God!
Lev called out as the cart jerked into motion. And let me know when you need more whiskey. The mule trotted out of the yard and turned onto the road, and Lev breathed easier.
How much did we get?
Said Sid.
What we asked for. 360 rubles each, minus five.
I'll stand the loss of the last coin.
Got a beg?
Sid produced a large leather purse. Lev counted 72 coins into it. He said goodbye to Sid and jumped off the cart near the U.S. officer's accommodation. As he was making his way to his room, he was accosted by Captain Hammond.
Peshkov, where have you been?
Lev wished he were not carrying 355 rubles in a Cossack saddlebag.
A little sightseeing, sir?
It's dark. That's why I came back. We've been looking for you. The colonel wants you.
Right away, sir.
Lev headed for his room to drop off the saddlebag, but Hammond said,
The colonel's office is the other way.
Yes, sir.
Lev turned around. Colonel Markham did not like Lev. The colonel was a career soldier, not a wartime recruit. He felt Lev did not share his commitment to excellence in the United States Army, and he was right. 110%, as the colonel himself might have put it. Lev considered parking the saddlebag on the floor outside the colonel's office door, but it was too much money to leave lying around.
Where the hell were you?
Said Markham as soon as Lev walked in.
Taking a look around town, sir. I'm reassigning you. Our British allies need interpreters, and they've asked me to second you to them.
It sounded like a soft option.
Yes, sir.
You'll be going with them to Omsk.
That was not so soft. Omsk was 4,000 miles away in the barbaric heartland of Russia.
What for, sir?
They will brief you.
Lev did not want to go. It was too far from home.
Are you asking me to volunteer, sir?
The colonel hesitated, and Lev realized the assignment was voluntary, insofar as anything was in the army.
Are you refusing the assignment?
Said Markham threateningly.
Only if it's voluntary, sir, of course.
I'll tell you the situation, Lieutenant, said the colonel. If you volunteer, I won't ask you to open that bag and show me what's inside.
Lev cursed under his breath. There was nothing he could do. The colonel was too damn sharp, and Grigori's fare to America was in the saddlebag. Omsk, he thought.
Hell.
I'd be glad to go, sir, he said.
4. Ethel went upstairs to Mildred's apartment. The place was clean but not tidy, with toys on the floor, cigarettes burning in an ashtray, and knickers drying in front of the fire.
Can you keep an eye on Lloyd tonight?
Ethel asked. She and Bernie were going to a Labour Party meeting. Lloyd was nearly 4 now and quite capable of getting out of bed and going for a walk on his own if not watched.
Of course, said Mildred.
They frequently watched each other's children in the evenings.
I've got a letter from Billy, Mildred said. Is he all right?
Yes, but I don't think he's in France. He doesn't say anything about the trenches.
He must be in the Middle East then. I wonder if he's seen Jerusalem.
The Holy City had been taken by British forces at the end of last year.
Adar will be pleased if he has. There's a message for you. He says he'll write later, but to tell you,
She reached into the pocket of her apron. Let me get it right. Believe me, I feel I am badly informed here about events in politics in Russia. Funny bloody message, really.
It's in code, Ethel said. Every third word counts. The message says, I am here in Russia.
What's he doing there?
I didn't know our army was in Russia, nor did I.
Does he mention a song or a book title?
Yeah. How did you know?
That's code, too.
He says to remind you of a song he used to sing called I'm with Freddy in the Zoo. I've never heard of it.
Nor have I. It's the initials. Freddy in the Zoo means Fitz.
Bernie came in wearing a red tie.
He's fast asleep, he said, meaning Lloyd.
Ethel said, Mildred's got a letter from Billy. He seems to be in Russia with Earl Fitzherbert.
Aha, said Bernie. I wondered how long it would take them.
What do you mean?
We've sent troops to fight the Bolsheviks. I knew it would happen.
We're at war with the new Russian government.
Not officially, of course.
Bernie looked at his watch. We need to go.
He hated to be late.
On the bus, Ethel said, We can't be unofficially at war. Either we are or we aren't. Churchill and that crowd know the British people won't support a war against the Bolsheviks, so they're trying to do it secretly.
Ethel said thoughtfully, I'm disappointed in Lenin.
He's just doing what he's got to do,
Bernie interrupted. He was a passionate supporter of the Bolsheviks.
Ethel went on, Lenin could become just as much of a tyrant as the Tsar.
That's ridiculous. But even so, he should be given a chance to show what he can do for Russia.
Well, we're in agreement about that, at least.
I'm not sure what we can do about it, though.
We need more information.
Billy will write to me soon. He'll give me the details.
Ethel felt indignant about the government's secret war, if that was what it was, but she was in an agony of worry about Billy. He would not keep his mouth shut. If he thought the army was doing wrong, he would say so and might get into trouble. The Calvary Gospel Hall was full. The Labour Party had gained popularity during the war. This was partly because the Labour leader, Arthur Henderson, had been in Lloyd George's war cabinet. Henderson had started work in a locomotive factory at the age of 12, and his performance as a cabinet minister had killed off the conservative argument that workers could not be trusted in government. Ethel and Bernie sat next to Jock Reed, a red-faced Glaswegian who had been Bernie's best friend when he was single. The chairman of the meeting was Dr. Greenwood. The main item on the agenda was the next general election. There were rumours that Lloyd George would call a national election as soon as the war ended. Aldgate needed a Labour candidate, and Bernie was the front-runner. He was proposed and seconded. Someone suggested Dr. Greenwood as an alternative, but the doctor said he felt he should stick to medicine. Then Jane McCulley stood up. She had been a party member ever since Ethel and Maud had protested against the withdrawal of her separation allowance, and Maud had been carried off to jail in the arms of a policeman. Now Jane said, I read in the paper that women can stand in the next election, and I propose that Ethel Williams should be our candidate. There was a moment of stunned silence, and then everyone tried to speak at the same time. Ethel was taken aback. She had not thought about this. Ever since she had known Bernie, he had wanted to be the local MP. She had accepted that. Besides, it had never been possible for women to be elected. She was not sure it was possible now. Her first inclination was to refuse immediately. Jane had not finished. She was a pretty young woman, but the softness of her appearance was deceptive, and she could be formidable. I respect Bernie, but he is an organizer and a meetings man, she said. Aldgate has a Liberal MP who is quite well-liked and may be hard to defeat. We need a candidate who can win this seat for Labour, someone who can say to the people of the East End, follow me to victory, and they will. We need Ethel. All the women cheered, and so did some of the men, though others muttered darkly. Ethel realized she would have a lot of support if she ran. And Jane was right. Bernie was probably the cleverest man in the room, but he was not an inspirational leader. He could explain how revolutions happened and why companies went bust, but Ethel could inspire people to join a crusade. Jock Reed stood up. Comrade Chairman, I believe the legislation does not permit women to stand. Dr. Greenwood said, I can answer that question. The law that was passed earlier this year, giving the vote to certain women over 30, did not provide for women to stand for election, but the government has admitted that this is an anomaly, and a further bill has been drafted. Jock persisted.
But the law, as it stands today, forbids the election of women, so we can't nominate one.
Ethel gave a wry smile. It was odd how men who called for world revolution could insist on following the letter of the law.
Dr. Greenwood said, "The Parliament's Qualification of Women Bill is clearly intended to become law before the next general election, so it seems perfectly in order for this branch to nominate a woman. But Ethel is under 30. Apparently this new bill applies to women over 21.
"Apparently," said Jock. "How can we nominate a candidate if we don't know the rules?"
Dr. Greenwood said, "Perhaps we should postpone nomination until the new legislation has been passed."
Bernie whispered something in Jock's ear, and Jock said,
"Let's ask Ethel if she's willing to stand. If not, then there's no need to postpone the decision."
Bernie turned to Ethel with a confident smile.
"All right," said Dr. Greenwood. "Ethel, if you were nominated, would you accept?"
Everyone looked at her. Ethel hesitated. This was Bernie's dream, and Bernie was her husband. But which of them would be the better choice for Labour? As the seconds passed, a look of incredulity came over Bernie's face. He had expected her to decline the nomination instantly. That hardened her resolve.
I've never considered it, she said. And, as the chairman said, it's not even a legal possibility yet, so it's a hard question to answer. I believe Bernie would be a good candidate, but all the same I'd like time to think about it. So perhaps we should accept the chairman's suggestion of a postponement.
She turned to Bernie. He looked as if he could kill her. Chapter 33. November 11th, 1918. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang at Fitz's house in Mayfair. Maud was still up, sitting in the drawing room with a candle, the portraits of dead ancestors looking down on her, the drawn curtains like shrouds, the pieces of furniture around her dimly visible, like beasts in a field at night. For the last few days she had hardly slept. A superstitious foreboding told her Walter would be killed before the war ended. She sat alone, with a cold cup of tea in her hands, staring into the coal fire, wondering where he was and what he was doing. Was he sleeping in a damp trench somewhere, or preparing for tomorrow's fighting? Or was he already dead? She could be a widow, having spent only 2 nights with her husband in 4 years of marriage. All she could be sure of was that he was not a prisoner of war. Johnny Remarque checked every list of captured officers for her. Johnny did not know her secret. He believed she was concerned only because Walter had been a dear friend of Fitz's before the war. The telephone bell startled her. At first, she thought it might be a call about Walter, but that would not make sense. News of a friend taken prisoner could wait until morning. It must be Fitz, she thought with agony. Could he have been wounded in Siberia? She hurried out to the hall, but Grout got there first. She realized with a guilty start that she had forgotten to give the staff permission to go to bed. "I will inquire whether Lady Maud is at home, my lord," Grout said into the apparatus. He covered the mouthpiece with his hand and said to Maud, "Lord Remarque at the War Office, my lady." She took the phone from Grout and said, "Is it Fitz? Is he hurt?"
"No, no," said Johnny. "Calm down, it's good news. The Germans have accepted the armistice terms."
"Oh, Johnny, thank God."
"They're all in the forest of Compiègne, north of Paris, on 2 trains in a railway siding. The Germans have just gone into the dining car of the French train. They're ready to sign."
"But they haven't signed yet."
"No, not yet. They're quibbling about the wording."
"Johnny, will you phone me again when they've signed? I shan't go to bed tonight."
"I will. Goodbye."
Maud gave the handset back to the butler. "The war may end tonight, Grout."
"I'm very happy to hear it, my lady. But you should go to bed."
"With your ladyship's permission, I'd like to stay up until Lord Remarque telephones again."
"Of course.
Would you like some more tea, my lady?"
2. The Aberowen pals arrived in Omsk early in the morning. Billy would always remember every detail of the 4,000-mile journey along the Trans-Siberian Railway from Vladivostok. It had taken 23 days, even with an armed sergeant posted in the locomotive to make sure the driver and fireman kept maximum speed. Billy was cold all the way. The stove in the center of the rail car hardly took the chill off the Siberian mornings. They lived on black bread and bully beef. But Billy found every day a revelation. He had not known there were places in the world as beautiful as Lake Baikal. The lake was longer from one end to the other than Wales, Captain Evans told them. From the speeding train they watched the sun rise over the still blue water, lighting the tops of the mile-high mountains on the far side, the snow turning to gold on the peaks. All his life he would cherish the memory of an endless caravan of camels alongside the railway line, the laden beasts plodding patiently through the snow, ignoring the 20th century as it hurtled past them in a clash of iron and a shriek of steam. "I'm a bloody long way from Aberdeen," he thought at that moment. But the most memorable incident was a visit to a high school in Cheetah. The train stopped there for 2 days while Colonel Fitzherbert parleyed with the local leader, a Cossack chieftain called Semenov. Billy attached himself to a party of American visitors on a tour. The principal of the school, who spoke English, explained that until a year ago he had taught only the children of the prosperous middle class, and the Jews had been banned, even if they could afford the fees. Now, by order of the Bolsheviks, education was free to all. The effect was obvious. His classrooms were crammed to bursting with children in rags, learning to read and write and count, and even studying science and art. Whatever else Lenin might have done, and it was difficult to separate the truth from the conservative propaganda, at least, Billy thought, he was serious about educating Russian children. On the train with him was Lev Peshkov. He had greeted Billy warmly, showing no sense of shame, as if he had forgotten being chased out of Aberdeen as a cheat and a thief. Lev had made it to America and married a rich girl, and now he was a lieutenant attached to the PALS as an interpreter. The population of Omsk cheered the battalion as they marched from the railway station to their barracks. Billy saw numerous Russian officers on the streets, wearing fancy old-fashioned uniforms, but apparently doing nothing military. There were also a lot of Canadian troops. When the battalion was dismissed, Billy and Tommy strolled around town. There was not much to look at: a cathedral, a mosque, a brick fortress, and a river busy with freight and passenger traffic. They were surprised to see many locals wearing bits and pieces of British Army uniform. A woman selling hot fried fish from a stall had on a khaki tunic. A delivery man with a handcart wore thick Army-issue serge trousers. A tall schoolboy with a satchel of books walked along the street in bright new British boots. "Where did they get them?" said Billy. "We supply uniforms to the Russian Army here, but Peshkov told me the officers sell them on the black market," Tommy said. "Serves us bloody well right for supporting the wrong side," said Billy. The Canadian YMCA had set up a canteen. Several of the PALS were already there. It seemed to be the only place to go. Billy and Tommy got hot tea and big wedges of apple tart, which North Americans called pie. "This town is the headquarters of the anti-Bolshevik reactionary government," Billy said. "I read it in the New York Times." The American papers, which had been available in Vladivostok, were more honest than the British. Lev Peshkov came in. With him was a beautiful young Russian girl in a cheap coat. They all stared at him. How did he do it so fast? Lev looked excited. "Hey, have you guys heard the rumor?" Lev probably always heard rumors first, Billy thought. Tommy said, "Yeah, we heard you're a homo." They all laughed. Billy said, "What rumor?" "They've signed an armistice." Lev paused. "Don't you get it? The war is over." "Not for us," said Billy. 3. Captain Dewar's platoon was attacking a small village called Oder's Eglise, east of the River Meuse. Gus had heard a rumor there would be a ceasefire at 11 a.m., but his commanding officer had ordered the assault, so he was carrying it out. He had moved his heavy machine guns forward to the edge of a spinney, and they were firing across a broad meadow at the outlying buildings, and giving the enemy plenty of time to retreat. Unfortunately, the Germans were not taking the opportunity. They had set up mortars and light machine guns in the farmyards and orchards, and were shooting back energetically. One gun in particular, firing from the roof of a barn, was effectively keeping half of Gus's platoon pinned down. Gus spoke to Corporal Kerry, the best shot in the unit. "Could you put a grenade into that barn roof?" Kerry, a freckled youth of 19, said, "If I could get a bit closer." "That's the problem." Kerry surveyed the terrain. "There's a bit of a rise a third of the way across the meadow," he said. "From there I could do it." "It's risky," Gus said. "Do you want to be a hero?" He looked at his watch. The war could be over in 5 minutes if the rumors are true. Kerry grinned. "I'll give it a try, Captain." Gus hesitated, reluctant to let Kerry risk his life. But this was the army, and they were still fighting, and orders were orders. "All right," Gus said. "In your own time." He half hoped Kerry would delay, But the boy immediately shouldered his rifle and picked up a case of grenades. Gus shouted, "All fire! Give Kerry as much cover as you can!" All the machine guns rattled and Kerry began to run. The enemy spotted him immediately and their guns opened up. He zigzagged across the field like a hare chased by dogs. German mortars exploded around him but miraculously missed. Kerry's bit of a rise was 300 yards away. He almost made it. The enemy machine gunner got Kerry perfectly in his sights and let fly with a long burst. Kerry was struck by a dozen rounds within a heartbeat. He flung up his arms, dropped his mortars and fell, momentum carrying him through the air until he landed a few paces from his rise. He lay quite still, and Gus thought he must have been dead before he hit the ground. The enemy gun stopped. After a few moments, the American stopped firing too. Gus thought he could hear the sound of distant cheering. All the men near him fell silent, listening. The Germans were cheering too. German soldiers began to appear, emerging from their shelters in the distant village. Gus heard the sound of an engine. An Indian brand American motorcycle came through the woods, driven by a sergeant with a major on the pillion. "Cease fire!" the major yelled. The motorcyclist was driving him along the line from one position to the next. "Cease fire!" he shouted again. "Cease fire!" Gus's platoon began to whoop. The men took off their helmets and threw them in the air. Some danced jigs, others shook one another's hands. Gus heard singing. Gus could not take his eyes off Corporal Kerry. He walked slowly across the meadow and knelt beside the body. He had seen many corpses, and he had no doubt Kerry was dead. He wondered what the boy's first name was. He rolled the body over. There were small bullet holes all over Kerry's chest. Gus closed the boy's eyes and stood up. "God forgive me," he said. 4. As it happened, both Ethel and Bernie were home from work that day. Bernie was ill in bed with influenza, and so was Lloyd's childminder, so Ethel was looking after her husband and her son. She felt very low. They had had a tremendous row about which of them was to be the parliamentary candidate. It was not merely the worst quarrel of their married life, it was the only one, and they had barely spoken to one another since. Ethel knew she was justified, but she felt guilty all the same. She might well make a better MP than Bernie, and anyway the choice should be made by their comrades, not by themselves. Bernie had been planning this for years, but that did not mean the job was his by right. Although Ethel had not thought of it before, she was now eager to run. Women had won the vote, but there was more to be done. First, the age limit must be lowered so that it was the same as for men. Then women's pay and working conditions needed improvement. In most industries, women were paid less than men even when doing exactly the same work. Why should they not get the same? But she was fond of Bernie, and when she saw the hurt on his face, she wanted to give in immediately. "I expected to be undermined by my enemies," he had said to her one evening. "The conservatives, the halfway house liberals, the capitalist imperialists, the bourgeoisie. I even expected opposition from one or two jealous individuals in the party. But there was one person I felt sure I could rely on, and she is the one who has sabotaged me." Ethel felt a pain in her chest when she thought about it. She took him a cup of tea at 11 o'clock. Their bedroom was comfortable, if shabby, with cheap cotton curtains, a writing table, and a photograph of Keir Hardie on the wall. Bernie put down his novel, The Ragged-Trousered Philanthropists, which all the socialists were reading. He said coldly, "What are you going to do tonight?" The Labour Party meeting was that evening. "Have you made the decision?" She had. She could have told him 2 days ago, but she had not been able to bring herself to utter the words. Now that he had asked the question, she would answer it. "It should be the best candidate," she said defiantly. He looked wounded. "I don't know how you can do this to me and still say you love me." She felt it was unfair of him to use such an argument. Why did it not apply in reverse? But that was not the point. "We shouldn't think of ourselves. We should think of the party. What about our marriage? I'm not giving way to you just because I'm your wife. You've betrayed me, but I am giving way to you," she said. "What?" "I said I am giving way to you." Relief spread across his face. She went on, "But it's not because I'm your wife, and it's not because you're the better candidate." He looked mystified. "What then?" Ethel sighed. "I'm pregnant." "Oh, my word." "Yes. Just at the moment when a woman can become a member of Parliament, I've fallen for a baby.
Bernie smiled.
Well then, everything's turned out for the best.
I knew you'd think that, Ethel said. At that moment she resented Bernie and the unborn baby and everything else about her life. Then she became aware that a church bell was ringing. She looked at the clock on the mantelpiece. It was 11:05. Why were they ringing at this time on a Monday morning? Then she heard another. She frowned and went to the window. She could see nothing unusual in the street, but more bells began. To the west, in the sky over central London, she saw a red flare, the kind they called the maroon. She turned back to Bernie.
It sounds as if every church in London is ringing its bells.
Something's happened, he said.
I'll bet it's the end of the war. They must be ringing for peace.
Well, said Ethel sourly, it's not for my bloody pregnancy.
5. Fitz's hopes for the overthrow of Lenin and his bandits were centred on the All-Russia Provisional Government, based in Omsk. It was not just Fitz, but powerful men in most of the world's major governments who looked to this town for the start of the counter-revolution. The five-man directory was housed in a railway train on the outskirts of the city. A series of armoured rail cars guarded by elite troops contained, Fitz knew, the remains of the imperial treasury, many millions of rubles worth of gold. The Tsar was dead, killed by the Bolsheviks, but his money was here to give power and authority to the loyalist opposition. Fitz felt he had a profound personal investment in the directory. The group of influential men he had assembled at Tí Gwen back in April formed a discreet network within British politics, and they had managed to foster Britain's clandestine but weighty encouragement of the Russian resistance. That, in turn, had brought support from other nations, or at least discouraged them from helping Lenin's regime, he felt sure. But foreigners could not do everything. It was the Russians themselves who had to rise up. How much could the directory achieve? Although it was anti-Bolshevik, its chairman was a socialist revolutionary, Nicholas D. Avkantsev. Fitz deliberately ignored him. The socialist revolutionaries were almost as bad as Lenin's lot. Fitz's hopes lay with the right wing and the military. Only they could be relied upon to restore the monarchy and private property. He went to see General Boldyrev, commander-in-chief of the Directory's Siberian army. The rail carriages occupied by the government were furnished with fading Tsarist splendour, worn velvet seats, chipped marquetry, stained lampshades and elderly servants wearing dirty remnants of the elaborate braided and beaded livery of the old St. Petersburg court. In one carriage there was a lipsticked young woman in a silk dress smoking a cigarette. Fitz was discouraged. He wanted to return to the old ways, but this setup seemed too backward-looking even for his taste. He thought with anger of Sergeant Williams's scornful mockery. "Is what we're doing legal?" Fitz knew the answer was doubtful. It was time he shut Williams up for good, he thought wrathfully. The man was practically a Bolshevik himself. General Boldyrev was a big, clumsy-looking figure. "We have mobilized 200,000 men," he told Fitz proudly. "Can you equip them?" "That's impressive," Fitz said, but he suppressed a sigh. This was the kind of thinking that had caused the Russian army of 6 million to be defeated by much smaller German and Austrian forces. Boldyrev even wore the absurd epaulettes favoured by the old regime, big round boards with fringes that made him look like a character in a comic opera by Gilbert and Sullivan. In his makeshift Russian, Fitz went on, "But if I were you, I'd send half the conscripts home." Boldyrev was baffled. "Why? At most we can equip 100,000, and they must be trained. Better to have a small, disciplined army than a great rabble who will retreat or surrender at the first opportunity." "Ideally, yes. The supplies we give you must be issued to men in the front line first, not to those in the rear." "Of course. Very sensible." Fitz had a dismal feeling that Boldyrev was agreeing without really listening. But he had to plough on. "Too much of what we send is going astray, as I can see by the number of civilians on the streets wearing articles of British Army uniform."
"Yes, quite.
I strongly recommend that all officers not fit to serve be deprived of their uniforms and asked to return to their homes." The Russian army was plagued by amateurs and elderly dilettantes who interfered with decisions but stayed away from the fighting.
And I suggest you give wider powers to Admiral Kolchak as Minister of War."
The Foreign Office thought Kolchak was the most promising of the members of the Directory.
"Very good, very good.
Are you willing to do all these things?" Fitz said, desperate to get some kind of commitment. Definitely. When?
All in good time, Colonel Fitzherbert. All in good time.
Fitz's heart sank. It was a good thing that men such as Churchill and Curzon could not see how unimpressive were the forces ranged against Bolshevism, he thought dismally. But perhaps they would shape up, with British encouragement. Anyway, he had to do his best with the materials to hand. There was a knock at the door and his aide-de-camp, Captain Murray, came in holding a telegram.
"Sorry to interrupt, sir," he said breathlessly, "but I feel sure you'll want to hear this news as soon as possible."
6. Mildred came downstairs in the middle of the day and said to Ethel, "Let's go up west." She meant the west end of London.
"Everyone's going," she said. "I've sent my girls home."
She was now employing two young seamstresses in her hat-trimming business.
"The whole East End is shutting up shop. It's the end of the war."
Ethel was eager to go. Her giving in to Bernie had not improved the atmosphere in the house much. He had cheered up, but she had become more bitter. It would do her good to get out of the house.
"I'll have to bring Lloyd," she said. "That's all right. I'll take Enid and Lil. They'll remember it all their lives. The day we won the war."
Ethel made Bernie a cheese sandwich for his lunch. Then she dressed Lloyd warmly and they set off. They managed to get on a bus, but soon it was full, with men and boys hanging on the outside. Every house seemed to be flying a flag, not just Union Jacks, but Welsh dragons, French tricolours, and the American stars and stripes. People were embracing strangers, dancing in the streets, kissing. It was raining, but no one cared. Ethel thought of all the young men who were now safe from harm, and she began to forget her troubles and share the joyous spirit of the moment. When they passed the theatres and entered the government district, the traffic slowed to a crawl. Trafalgar Square was a heaving mass of rejoicing humanity. The bus could go no farther, and they got off. They made their way along Whitehall to Downing Street. They could not get near Number 10 because of the crush of people hoping for a sight of Prime Minister Lloyd George, the man who won the war. They went into St. James's Park, which was full of couples embracing in the bushes. On the far side of the park, thousands of people stood outside Buckingham Palace. They were singing "Keep the Home Fires Burning." When the song ended, they began, "Now thank we all our God." Ethel saw that a slim young woman in a tweed suit was conducting the singing, standing on top of a lorry, and she reflected that a girl would not have dared to do such a thing before the war. They crossed the street to Green Park, hoping to get nearer the palace. A young man smiled at Mildred, and when she smiled back, he put his arms around her and kissed her. She returned the kiss enthusiastically.
"You seem to enjoy that," Ethel said a bit enviously as the boy walked away.
"I did," said Mildred. "I'd have sacked him off if he'd asked me."
"I won't tell Billy that," Ethel said with a laugh.
"Billy's not daft. He knows what I'm like." They circled the crowd and reached the street called Constitution Hill. The crush thinned out there, but they were at the side of Buckingham Palace, so they would not be able to see the king if he decided to come out onto the balcony. Ethel was wondering where to go next when a troop of mounted police came down the road, causing people to scurry out of the way. Behind them came a horse-drawn open carriage, and inside, smiling and waving, were the king and queen. Ethel recognized them immediately, remembering them vividly from their visit to Aberowen almost 5 years ago. She could hardly believe their luck as the carriage came slowly toward her. The king's beard was grey, she saw. It had been dark when he came to Tiguin. He looked exhausted but happy. Beside him, the queen was holding an umbrella to keep the rain off her hat. Her famous bosom seemed even larger than before.
"Look, Lloyd," Ethel said. "It's the king."
The carriage came within inches of where Ethel and Mildred stood. Lloyd called out loudly,
"Hello, king."
The king heard him and smiled.
"Hello, young man," he said, and then he was gone.
7. Grigori sat in the dining car of the armoured train and looked across the table. The man sitting opposite was chairman of the Revolutionary War Council and People's Commissar for Military and Naval Affairs. That meant he commanded the Red Army. His name was Lev Davidovich Bronstein, but like most of the leading revolutionaries, he had adopted an alias, and he was known as Leon Trotsky. He was a few days past his 39th birthday, and he held the fate of Russia in his hands. The revolution was a year old, and Grigori had never been so worried about it. The storming of the Winter Palace had seemed like a conclusion, but in fact it had been only the beginning of the struggle. The most powerful governments of the world were hostile to the Bolsheviks. Today's armistice meant they could now turn their full attention to destroying the revolution, and only the Red Army could stop them. Many soldiers disliked Trotsky because they thought he was an aristocrat and a Jew. It was impossible to be both in Russia, but soldiers were not logical. Trotsky was no aristocrat, though his father had been a prosperous farmer, and Trotsky had had a good education. But his high-handed manners did him no favors, and he was foolish enough to travel with his own chef and clothe his staff in new boots and gold buttons. He looked older than his years. His great mop of curly hair was still black, but his face was now lined with strain. He had worked miracles with the army. The Red Guards who overthrew the provisional government had proved less effective on the battlefield. They were drunken and ill-disciplined. Deciding tactics by a show of hands at a soldier's meeting had turned out to be a poor way to fight, even worse than taking orders from aristocratic dilettantes. The Reds had lost major battles against the counter-revolutionaries, who were beginning to call themselves the Whites. Trotsky had reintroduced conscription, against howls of protest. He had drafted many former Tsarist officers, calling them specialists, and put them back into their old posts. He had also brought back the death penalty for deserters. Grigory did not like these measures, but he saw the necessity. Anything was better than counter-revolution. What kept the army together was a corps of Bolshevik party members. They were carefully spread through all units to maximize their impact. Some were ordinary soldiers. Some held command posts. Some, such as Grigory, were political commissars, working alongside the military commanders and reporting back to the Bolshevik Central Committee in Moscow. They maintained morale by reminding soldiers they were fighting for the greatest cause in the history of humankind. When the army was obliged to be ruthless and cruel, requisitioning grain and horses from desperately poor peasant families, the Bolsheviks would explain to the soldiers why it was necessary for the greater good, and they reported rumblings of discontent early, so that such talk could be crushed before it spread. But would all this be enough? Grigory and Trotsky were bent over a map. Trotsky pointed to the Transcaucasia region between Russia and Persia. "The Turks are still in control of the Caspian Sea, with some German help," he said. "Threatening the oil fields," Grigory muttered. "Denikin is strong in the Ukraine. Thousands of aristocrats, officers, and bourgeois fleeing the revolution had ended up in Novocherkassk, where they had formed a counter-revolutionary force under the renegade General Denikin. The so-called volunteer army," said Grigory. "Exactly." Trotsky's finger moved to the north of Russia. "The British have a naval squadron at Murmansk. There are 3 battalions of American infantry at Archangel. They are supplemented by just about every other country. Canada, China, Poland, Italy, Serbia. It might be quicker to list the nations that don't have troops in the frozen north of our country. And then Siberia." Trotsky nodded. "The Japanese and Americans have forces in Vladivostok. The Czechs control most of the Trans-Siberian Railway. The British and Canadians are in Omsk, supporting the so-called All-Russia Provisional Government." Grigory had known much of this, but he had not previously looked at the picture as a whole. "Why, we're surrounded," he said. "Exactly. And now that the capitalist imperialist powers have made peace, they will have millions of troops free." Grigory sought for a ray of hope. "On the other hand, in the last 6 months we have increased the size of the Red Army from 300,000 to 1 million men. I know." Trotsky was not cheered by this reminder, but it's not enough. 8. Germany was in the throes of a revolution, and to Walter it looked horribly like the Russian Revolution of a year ago. It started with a mutiny. Naval officers ordered the fleet at Kiel to put to sea and attack the British in a suicide mission. But the sailors knew an armistice was being negotiated, and they refused. Walter had pointed out to his father that the officers were going against the wishes of the Kaiser. So they were the mutineers, and the sailors were the loyal ones. This argument had made Otto apoplectic with rage. After the government tried to suppress the sailors, the city of Kiel was taken over by a workers' and soldiers' council, modeled on the Russian Soviets. 2 days later, Hamburg, Bremen, and Cuxhaven were controlled by Soviets. The day before yesterday, the Kaiser had abdicated. Walter was fearful. He wanted democracy, not revolution. But on the day of the abdication, workers in Berlin had marched in their thousands, waving red flags, and the extreme leftist, Karl Liebknecht, had declared Germany a free socialist republic. Walter did not know how it would end. The armistice was a dreadfully low moment. He had always believed the war to be a terrible mistake, but there was no satisfaction in being right. The fatherland had been defeated and humiliated, and his fellow countrymen were starving. He sat in the drawing room of his parents' house in Berlin, leafing through the newspapers, too depressed even to play the piano. The wallpaper was faded and the picture rail dusty. There were loose blocks in the aging parquet floor, but no craftsman to repair it. Walter could only hope that the world would learn a lesson. President Wilson's 14 points provided a gleam of light that might just herald the rising sun. Was it possible that the giants among nations would find a way to resolve their differences peacefully? He was infuriated by an article in a right-wing paper. "This fool of a journalist says the German army was never defeated," he said as his father came into the room. "He claims we were betrayed by Jews and socialists at home. We must stamp out that kind of nonsense." Otto was angrily defiant. "Why should we?" he said. "Because we know it's not true. I think we were betrayed by Jews and socialists." "What?" Walter said incredulously. "It wasn't Jews and socialists who turned us back at the Marne twice. We lost the war. We were weakened by the lack of supplies. That was the British blockade. And whose fault was it that the Americans came in? It was not Jews and socialists who demanded unrestricted submarine warfare and sank ships with American passengers. It is the socialists who have given in to the Allies' outrageous armistice terms." Walter was almost incoherent with rage. "You know perfectly well that it was Ludendorff who asked for an armistice. Chancellor Ebert was appointed only the day before yesterday. How can you blame him? If the army was still in charge, we would never have signed today's document. But you're not in charge, because you lost the war. You told the Kaiser you could win it, and he believed you, and in consequence he lost his crown. How will we learn from our mistakes if you let the German people believe such lies as these? They will be demoralized if they think we were defeated. They should be demoralized. The leaders of Europe did something wicked and foolish, and 10 million men died as a result. At least let the people understand that, so that they will never let it happen again." "No," said his father. Part 3. The World Made New. Chapter 34. November to December 1918. Ethel woke early on the morning after Armistice Day, shivering in the stone-floored kitchen. Waiting for the kettle to boil on the old-fashioned range, she made a resolution to be happy. There was a lot to be happy about. The war was over and she was going to have a baby. She had a faithful husband who adored her. Things had not turned out exactly how she wanted, but she would not let that make her miserable. She would paint her kitchen a cheerful yellow, she decided. Bright colors in kitchens were a new fashion. But first she had to try to mend her marriage. Bernie had been mollified by her surrender, but she had continued to feel bitter, and the atmosphere in the house had remained poisoned. She was angry, but she did not want the rift to be permanent. She wondered if she could make friends. She took 2 cups of tea into the bedroom and got back into bed. Lloyd was still asleep in his cot in the corner. "How do you feel?" she said, as Bernie sat up and put his glasses on. "Better, I think. Stay in bed another day. Make sure you've got rid of it completely." "I might do that." His tone was neutral, neither warm nor hostile. She sipped hot tea. "What would you like, a boy or a girl?" He was silent, and at first she thought he was sulkily refusing to answer, but in fact he was just thinking for a few moments, as he often did before answering a question. At last he said, "Well, we've got a boy, so it would be nice to have one of each." She felt a surge of affection for him. He always talked as if Lloyd was his own child. "We've got to make sure this is a good country for them to grow up in," she said, "where they can get good schooling and a job and a decent house to bring up their own children. And no more wars. Lloyd George will call a snap election. Do you think so? He's the man who won the war. He'll want to get re-elected before that wears off. I think Labour will still do well. We've got a chance in places like Aldgate anyway." Ethel hesitated. "Would you like me to manage your campaign?" Bernie looked doubtful. "I've asked Jock Reed to be my agent." "Jock can deal with the legal documents and finance," Ethel said. "I'll organize meetings and so on. I can do it much better." Suddenly she felt this was about their marriage, not just the campaign. "Are you sure you want to?" "Yes. Jock would just send you to make speeches. You'll have to do that, of course, but it's not your strong point. You're better sitting down with a few people, talking over a cup of tea. I'll get you into factories and warehouses where you can chat to the men informally.
I'm sure you're right, Bernie said. She finished her tea and put the cup and saucer on the floor beside the bed.
So you're feeling better?
Yes.
She took his cup and saucer, put them down, then pulled her nightdress over her head. Her breasts were not as perky as they had been before she got pregnant with Lloyd, but they were still firm and round.
Oh, much better, she said.
He stared. A lot. They had not made love since the evening Jane McCulley had proposed Ethel as a candidate. Ethel was missing it badly. She held her breasts in her hands. The cold air in the room was making her nipples stand up.
Do you know what these are?
I believe they're your bosoms. Some people call them tits. I call them beautiful. His voice had become a little hoarse. Would you like to play with them?
All day long.
I'm not sure about that, she said, but make a start and we'll see how we go.
All right.
Ethel sighed happily. Men were so simple. An hour later she went to work, leaving Lloyd with Bernie. There were not many people on the streets. London had a hangover this morning. She reached the office of the National Union of Garment Workers and sat at her desk. Peace would bring new industrial problems, she realized, as she thought about the working day ahead of her. Millions of men leaving the army would be looking for employment, and they would want to elbow aside the women who had been doing their jobs for 4 years. But those women needed their wages. They did not all have a man coming home from France. A lot of their husbands were buried there. They needed their union and they needed Ethel. Whenever the election came, the union would naturally be campaigning for the Labour Party. Ethel spent most of the day in planning meetings. The evening papers brought surprising news about the election. Lloyd George had decided to continue the coalition government into peacetime. He would not campaign as leader of the Liberals, but as head of the coalition. That morning he had addressed 200 Liberal MPs at Downing Street and won their support. At the same time, Bonar Law had persuaded Conservative MPs to back the idea. Ethel was baffled. What were people supposed to vote for? When she got home, she found Bernie furious.
It's not an election, it's a bloody coronation, he said. King David Lloyd George. What a traitor. He has a chance to bring in a radical left-wing government, and what does he do? Sticks with his Conservative pals. He's a bloody turncoat.
Let's not give up yet, said Ethel. 2 days later, the Labour Party withdrew from the coalition and announced it would campaign against Lloyd George. 4 Labour MPs, who were government ministers, refused to resign and were smartly expelled from the party. The date of the election was set for December 14th. To give time for soldiers' ballots to be returned from France and counted, the results would not be announced until after Christmas. Ethel started drawing up Bernie's campaigning schedule. 2. On the day after Armistice Day, Maud wrote to Walter on her brother's crested writing paper and put the letter in the red pillar box on the street corner. She had no idea how long it would take for normal post to be resumed, but when it happened, she wanted her envelope to be on top of the pile. Her message was carefully worded, just in case.